Namyoho Renge Kyo, Namyoho Renge Kyo, Namyoho Renge Kyo. Homage to the Siddharma Pundarika Sutra, the wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra. Homage to Vulture Peak. This is Vulture Peak. Brought this back from the top of Gridhakuta Vulture Peak in Rajagriha, where the Buddha taught the Lotus Sutra, just yards from this very stone. This stone must have been there before the embodied Shakyamuni Buddha taught there 2,500 years ago. So the stone received the teaching face to face. I like to tell people that I climbed it to the very top and broke the tip off and took it home.
Go to jail?
Maybe, yeah. I stashed it quickly in my bag and made it through customs. And yes, Yara was there. We had a little Santa Cruz contingent on Vulture Peak with Ken and Rachel and Yara and Scott Bongiorno, as well as many other Zen practitioners a few years ago. We happened to find ourselves at the foot of Vulture Peak, and the dry, hot, dusty plains of northern India. And we climbed up there. I think it was about like an hour hike.
People selling things along the way.
Mm-hmm. And wild monkeys.
Wild, aggressive monkeys at the bottom.
Intense monkeys that were like that were just totally wrapped up in monkey mind, and we tried to bring many like lotus flowers to offer to the Buddhas and things like that, but the if the flowers smell nice, these monkeys go wild and they try to like grab the flowers out of your hand. It was like kind of hard to get anything up to the top of that mountain without the monkeys stealing it, basically. Yeah, it was a little scary. It's sort of like the gateway to the top of the mountain. There's these like huge packs of wild monkeys like freaking out.
Big ones,
like, oh yeah. Like this. Yeah. And like, not afraid of humans. You got some flowers for Buddha? We'll take them. Because we eat them. To carry them like this.
Caves.
There's caves on Vulture Peak. Mm-hmm. Ananda's cave and Ma Kashyapa's cave, and you can sit in the coolness. And when we made it to the top, it was a big sky up there. And we gathered our sangha and we wholeheartedly chanted the Lotus Sutra's lifespan of the Tathagata. In a new language of English. Rarely chanted atop Vulture's Peak and dedicated the merit. And we went hunting for Udambara flowers and Mandarava flowers. And we sat zazen on this small terrace. The top of Vulture Peak is surprisingly small. Like, you know, it's enough for us to kind of gather in a flat spot, but it's not like a big plain or field or anything. There's some ruins of some old temples. So there's an old photo you can't quite see from the top. But I think I've been up Vulture Peak 4 times over the last 30 years, and it's definitely a sacred place that I hope to go again. Very moving to, so like the sutra says, thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was staying in Rajagriha on sacred Vulture Peak with a large group of monks, 12,000 in all. So it's inconceivable how they would all fit up there. Yes, it was like a large pinhead, and many bodhisattvas can dance on the head of a Vulture Peak pin. And in chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra, what's generally considered in China and Japan to be the pretty much like the central peak of the sutra is this chapter 16 on the lifespan of the Tathagata. There's a parable. There's many wonderful parables in the wonderful Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra. And here's the one in chapter 16. The Buddha says, suppose, for instance, there's a fine physician, doctor, who's wise and clever and knows how to make medicines for curing all sorts of disease. He has many children, 10, 20, even 100. To take care of some business, he goes off to a distant land. And when he's gone, his children drink some poisonous drugs, which drives them into deliriums of agony and leaves them writhing on the ground. The children of this doctor somehow came upon and imbibed this poison, grasping, aversion, and confusion. Greed, hate, and delusion are the three poisons. They drank the poison of craving and grasping to be somebody other than they already are. They drank the poison of aversion to their present experience, thinking there's some alternative. They drank the poison of confusion about what's the appropriate response here and now. And they were driven into deliriums of agony, writhing on the ground. Of course, this is a metaphor for this world of samsara and the pains and agonies that ensue from these three poisons. At this point, the parent comes back, the good doctor parent. See if I can say parent, because it could be a mother instead of a father. She comes home to find that the children have drunk the poison. Some have lost their minds and others have not. they're just mildly poisoned, and some are like completely, totally poisoned. That's how it is, right? Seeing their parent in the distance, they're all very happy. Kneeling to greet her, they say, "How good it is that you've returned safely. Foolishly, we've taken some poison by mistake." I mean, it was there in the medicine cabinet. We might even say that, like, where did they get this poison? In the doctor's house? Well, the doctor has all these potions, and maybe some of them, as we heard actually in the Parinirvana Sutra, sometimes these substances function as medicines and sometimes as poisons. In the Nirvana Sutra, there's the milk medicine, which turned out to be really toxic and poisonous for a lot of people. The teaching of self seemed to really poison a lot of people. But then when the time was ready, the Buddha prescribed this very milk medicine, and it was great medicine, teaching of self, for people who were no longer confused by the teaching of self. So, the children say, "Please heal us and give us back our lives." The father, mother, parent sees his children in such suffering and agony, and following various formulas, looks for good medicinal herbs, perfect in color, fragrance, and flavor. Then she pounds, sifts, and mixes them, and gives them to her children, telling them, "This excellent medicine is perfect in color, fragrance, and flavor. Take it, and you will quickly be rid of your suffering and agony and be free from the illness." So she mixed together good medicine. Some medicine's really bitter, but this was actually good tasting, good smelling, and good looking medicine. Perfect in color, fragrance, and taste, and potency. And maybe the doctor, for the particular poison of greed, maybe the doctor mixed the medicine of generosity as a cure. Maybe for the poison of hatred and aversion, the doctor mixed the medicine of patience and acceptance. Maybe for the poison of delusion and confusion, the doctor mixed the medicine of wisdom and clarity, understanding. Those children who had not lost their minds, seeing this excellent medicine of good color and fragrance, take it immediately and are completely cured of their illness. They were somewhat poisoned, but they hadn't completely lost their mind, so they were willing to take the medicine of generosity and patience and clarity. But those who were really poisoned were like, didn't even want the medicine. The others who lost their minds completely are happy to see their father return and ask him to heal their illness. Yet when the medicine is given to them, they refuse to take it. Why? Because the poison has penetrated deeply into them and they have lost their minds completely. Even though this medicine has good color and fragrance, they think it's no good. The mother thinks to herself, "These poor children, because of the poison in them, their minds are completely unbalanced. Though they are glad to see me and ask to be healed, they refuse to take this good medicine. Now I must use some skillful means. Major theme of the sutra is upaya kaushalya, skillful means. Means like some method, some maybe unusual and creative way to help benefit beings and free them from suffering. So the doctor says to them, "You should know that I am now worn out with old age, and the time for me to die has now arrived. I will leave this excellent medicine here. You should take it and not worry that it will not make you better." After instructing them in this way, the doctor leaves again for another land, from which she sends back a messenger to inform them, "Your mother, your father, your parent is dead." Now when those children hear that their parent has died and left them behind, they become very distressed and think to themselves, "If our father were alive, he would have been kind to us and would have saved us. But now he's abandoned us and died in a distant land. We think of ourselves as orphans with no one to rely on." This continuous grief brings them to their senses. That seems to be in this parable seems to be the pivotal event here that happens. The skillful means seem to be to actually in a way kind of like help them to grieve, and the continuous grief brings them to their senses. That's how I understand here. Yes.
It reminds me a little bit of the idea of hitting rock bottom.
Yes.
If you get bad enough,
yes,
then maybe become receptive.
Yeah.
You're constant doing the wrong thing for long enough.
That's a great point. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if us poisoned ones are not quite at rock bottom, and we're kind of making do, then we're not really open to help. But when we hit rock bottom, like, if there's no, I'm like at the end of my rope, at the end of my life, things couldn't get any worse, that's when we open. Ironically, and I think even in practice, it's somewhat like this. In Zen practice, it might not necessarily be rock bottom, but we have to really acknowledge that we have some discontent. I think a lot of people come to Zen practice in particularly difficult situations. They've just lost their job or their marriage or their health or a loved one or some major difficulties going on in their life, and I need some like spiritual practice. So they come and it actually helps them, and the passage of time, they get used to the situation and their life starts going well again. And then sometimes such people stop practicing. I actually seen it quite a bit, you know. So we need to acknowledge that we're having some discontent. When things are going well, it's harder to practice, harder to find the motivation. I myself felt like this early on in practice. I felt like things are going pretty well for me, and it scares me. Things are going a little too well, which makes me a little bit complacent. So when I'm having a hard time, it kind of reminds me that I have to practice. So I think this is a good point. Mm-hmm. In this case, this grief of losing their father. And in this case, I can imagine that you understand the doctor and parent is the Buddha. And when the Buddha's around with all his great medicinal Dharma teachings, we think, well, there's time enough later. It's so great to hang around the Buddha, and we'll try some of his medicines later. But, like, it's going okay now. But then when he's gone, the children might feel, oh, really, he's gone? He left us with some medicine, though. And so the Buddha goes on. They recognize that the medicine, when the grief brings them to their senses, they recognize that the medicine is excellent in color, fragrance, and flavor. And they take it and are fully healed of the poison. The father, hearing that the children have all recovered, returns home immediately. So they all see him again. Buddha says, good disciples, what do you think? Can anyone say that this fine physician is lying? And they say, no, world-honored one. So and the Buddha says, I too am like this. Since I became Buddha, innumerable, unlimited, hundreds of thousands of billions of myriads of countless eons have passed. But for the sake of living beings, I use the power of skillful means and say that I will enter parinirvana, cessation. But it's not really lying. Now, we could say, strictly speaking, literally, we could say it is kind of lying, but lying in terms of the precepts to benefit others. You could say it's using skillful means to help, so it's technically maybe is lying, but that's the spirit of the Bodhisattva precepts, is they're always about benefiting beings. So if you're hiding in an innocent person who's been falsely accused in your basement, and the accusers are looking for him to come and kill this person, and they ask, is he in your basement? You can lie and say, no, he's not, to save this person. In fact, the spirit of the Bodhisattva precepts is the Bodhisattva vows to lie if they're really, really clear that it's going to benefit beings. Instead of, well, no, I can't lie, so yeah, go ahead, kill him, even though he's innocent. He's down there in the basement. That's the spirit of Bodhisattva precepts. Early Buddha precepts were just like, no matter what, just never lie, even if it's going to harm the person. No exceptions. That's the kind of this Mahayana shift from literal meaning to compassionate meaning. That is this story of the inconceivable lifespan of the Buddha doesn't use these terms of the three Buddha bodies. But because it's an early Mahayana sutra, these three Buddha bodies, which I'll mention in a minute, had not yet emerged in the world at the time of this Lotus Sutra. So it's almost like it's an early version, a kind of a seed form of the three Buddha body teaching, which became really important in Mahayana Buddha Dharma. So the three bodies are Dharmakaya, Nirmanakaya, and Sambhogakaya. And Dharmakaya teachings, the Dharma body, the reality body, that teaching was already present at the time of this Lotus Sutra. In the early Prajnaparamita sutras, the teaching (clears throat) is sometimes taught like this. A Tathagata, a Buddha, cannot be seen by his rupakaya. Rupa means form. So in this early, this is the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines, maybe a century or two before the Lotus Sutra, it emerged. The Buddha cannot be seen by his form body, his rupakaya. The dharmakaya, we could say the reality body, is really the Tathagata, the Buddha. And the real nature of phenomena, or dharma, does not come or go. So this Perfection of Wisdom Sutra says, there is no coming or going of the body of an elephant, a horse, or a chariot, which has been conjured up by a magician. So, and I guess this is kind of a common thing in ancient India, that magicians could manifest these illusory things like elephants, because it comes up in the sutras quite a bit. And so it's saying, this elephant that's like a magical apparition created by a magician in a circus sideshow, that elephant actually doesn't come and go. Does that make sense? The elephant that's just an illusion created by the magician, that elephant, that kind of elephant, actually doesn't come and go. We might say the illusion comes and goes, but the actual elephant doesn't even arrive. It's just an illusion, right? We might say, in the metaphor, real elephants come and go, but the magical illusion of the elephant doesn't come and go. It doesn't change. It doesn't do anything because it's not an elephant. It's just a magical apparition. That's the way that Prajnaparamita sutras talk. There is no coming or going of the body of an elephant or horse or chariot which has been conjured up by a magician. Just so, there is no coming or going of the Tathagatas. So it's kind of implying that in the Prajnaparamita, that the form bodies of people and Buddhas and everything is kind of like a magical apparition. These apparitions don't come and go. The true nature, the true Dharma body of the Tathagata doesn't arise and cease. So that's a teaching of Dharmakaya. And also we heard in the Parinirvana Sutra, Dharmakaya was a theme in there, and definitely presents it as eternal Dharmakaya. And then Nirmanakaya is similar to this Rupakaya, like form body, but the actual use of the term Nirmanakaya, which means like, I think kind of like manifestation or almost like a magical apparition body. I think Nirmana is really transformation body. So it's going a little further than just form body. It's emphasizing how Nirmanakaya, this appearing body, is like a transformation of the reality body. And that first started getting used in like the Flower Ornament Sutra. I think the term Nirmanakaya first started appearing. And then Sambhogakaya is... I recently found out, and I was kind of amazed to find out, that this term Sambhogakaya was never used by the Buddha. It's not in any sutras at all. These three kayas is like a major Mahayana teaching. The other two are in the sutras, as you just heard. Sambhogakaya was a term apparently invented by Asanga, the brother of Vasubandhu, the co-founders of the Yogacara tradition. And they talk quite a bit about these three bodies. And a sangha made up this word. And now we just, it's like mainstream Buddhist teaching. So now what about these bodies? Just to keep it simple for now. I heard that Juri, who I mentioned yesterday, is the founder of Tian Tai School in China. He puts it very nicely, I think. Dharmakaya, the reality body of Buddha, is the truth that is realized by Buddhas. We could say that, we could call it emptiness, we could call it Buddha nature, we could call it non-duality. But the ultimate truth realized by the Buddhas is Dharmakaya. And the realization of that truth is the Sambhogakaya. Yeah. We might even say, like, the knowing of emptiness is the Sambhogakaya. See how those are different? One's just the reality, the eternal reality of emptiness, whether anyone realizes it or not. Try it's doesn't depend on anybody realizing it or not. It's always, all dharmas are always marked by emptiness. Reality is not broken into subjects and objects. It really is non-dual, whether sentient beings realize that or not. But the realization of it is the Sambhogakaya. Knowing non-duality, knowing emptiness is the Sambhogakaya. And then Nirmanakaya is the compassionate expression of this realization as a appearing person in the world. So we used to say Shakyamuni Buddha, who could speak in the sutras, was like a Nirmanakaya. We could say Buddha's three bodies. The one that has two eyes and two ears and nose and tongue and a tiny hair curl on his forehead is that one that appears is Nirmanakaya. He is the compassionate expression of the realization of emptiness. But the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, is also the realization. It's almost like who he really is the realization of emptiness or Buddha nature. And even deeper, who he really is the actual emptiness itself, is the Buddha nature itself. I think it's a pretty simple way to understand the three bodies of Buddha, according to Juri. The Dharmakaya is the actual truth, reality. The Sambhogakaya is the realization or knowing of that truth, and the Nirmanakaya is the compassionate expression of the truth, of the realized truth, as what we would call like a person who's benefiting beings in the world. So, in this Lotus Sutra, which of these three Buddha bodies do you think is Shakyamuni Buddha? Yeah, really, all of them. We could say the one that's actually speaking, that's named Shakyamuni Buddha, is the Nirmanakaya, and now, if we said he had an eternal lifespan, as later tradition started to sort of tweak the teaching, that it's really just talking about an inconceivably long lifespan, it sort of morphed, at least in Japan, the teaching started morphing into just calling it for short eternal lifespan. And maybe they did that partly to say, if we say eternal lifespan, then we could call it Dharmakaya, the unchanging reality. But those who were being a little more strict about what the sutra actually says, doesn't really say eternal. It just says, you know, countless eons ago, I realized Buddhahood. And so the ones that are saying that kind of one, that kind of lifespan that goes on for countless kalpas, but that actually had a beginning realization, that one they say is the Sambhogakaya. Interestingly. Because Sambhogakaya is a realization, right? It's a realization that happens at a particular time. And then afterwards, after that realization, for, you know, a Buddha's realization, you could say, is so complete that then there's no end anymore. And they might say what they actually realized is that, as we heard yesterday, that they were always Buddha before that, but they really kind of, you could say, manifested this Sambhogakaya realization at the time of realizing that completely. Can you follow that? This really, really long lifespan began at a certain point, at a certain realization, and so that the so-called, inconceivable lifespan of the Buddha is actually referring to Sambhogakaya, according to, like, journey. There is, for us, sentient beings who, probably have a little bit of poison in us, we might not fully and always know that we are Buddha totally complete. And so we forget, so we have to keep practicing endlessly. But it seems to be that part of the story here, part of the Mahayana understanding, is that this Buddhahood, supreme Buddhahood of the Shakyamuni Buddha, is like, kind of like the point of no return. Like, that's why it began at a certain point, but then it goes on. The number of eons that have passed without forgetting has gone on up to today. So that's maybe like, we might feel like, well, I don't feel like I definitely have some insight from practice, but can we sustain it for eons? We might feel like, especially this, I think this transition between lives is a little shaky. I mean, I've heard that like, we go, it's discombobulating to die. I've heard. There's a lot of stuff happens after this life ends, and maybe before the next life begins, and a lot of what happens, it's so confusing and discombobulating that almost everybody forgets everything they learned previously in their previous lifetime. It's part of the story of the tradition. But these Buddhas, they've realized that they don't even really die. And they don't get discombobulated and around this death business. So there's something kind of awesome about this version of kind of classic version of three Buddha bodies. In like Zen tradition, where we try to bring these awesome stories a little bit more down to earth, we talk about these three bodies as our own nature right now, like the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. We hear teachings that are using the same idea, that actual emptiness and non-duality is our Dharma body right now, and which is true. It's kind of like the Buddha nature. We all have that Dharma body. The realization or the knowing of that could be like just a glimpse into that, or even could go so far as to say, even just knowing at all, our cognitive awareness itself, this kind of like, what we're actually knowing right now is the Dharmakaya. And the fact that we're knowing at all is like our Sambhogakaya, our the luminosity of our awareness, the brightness of knowing at all. There's something it's like to know a world. There's something it's like to be aware. Isn't there? Like just our ordinary awareness right now. There's something it's like to be aware. We can't quite say what it is, but there is something it is like to be aware. We know we're aware. It's unarguable. And though we can't quite describe it quite accurately, we can't quite say what it is, there is something it is like to be alive, to be aware. And we could say, that's something it's like to be aware. In the Zen tradition, we could say, is Sambhogakaya, is our bliss body. And then appreciating this ordinary awareness and the possibility that nothing's really coming and going. Maybe our heart opens more and more. We feel more and more inseparable from others. We feel like, since there's something it's like for me to be aware, and there's something it's like for you to be aware, I kind of have a strong intuition that there's something it's like for you to be aware. I don't know for sure, but I know there's something it's like for me to be aware, so I'm pretty sure there's something it's like for you to be aware. Now, there's also something it's like to be having this particular experience of talking through this mouth and sitting on the seat. And in that case, I think there's something it's like for you to be hearing these sounds and sitting on your seat, but that's a little different. I kind of intuit you see the room a little bit different from a different angle. So that's not what I'm talking about. Even though there's something it's like to be an experiencer for each of us, that's something it is like is a little bit different. But there's also experiencing, and there's something it's like to be just purely experiencing, and that one might not actually be different. Do you see what I mean? Like the experiencer is a little bit different, even though there is something it's like to be an experiencer. It's all slightly different. The experience we're having, the bodily sensations that you're having and I'm having, there's something it's like an experience. There's something it's like to be an experience, to have an experience, and that is a little bit different for each of us. But the experiencing, just the pure knowing of this different content, there's something it's like to be experiencing, and that one I would propose is identical for all of us.
So, I've not heard you before use that phrase, it's something it's like, and I believe in the past you liken experiencing or awareness to Buddha nature itself, that it's the same thing. And I take that back home, and the people I practice with, it makes them uncomfortable. They don't want to hear it because they want the uncertainty, the not knowing, the undescribable.
It is undescribable.
Yeah, but now when you use those words, it's something it's like, it leaves it a little bit undescribable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It would be more palatable if I take it back home.
Try it out.
Yeah.
I this something it is like is, I did not make up this phrase. It came from Thomas Nagel. I knew he was Nagel, but is it Thomas?
I think so.
Thomas Nagel. Does anyone else know Thomas Nagel? Is that right?
It's a very seminal article that he wrote.
Yeah.
What is it like to be a bat?
To be a bat.
It's a wonderful article.
Cool. I'm glad somebody else knows this. I think in the last year I heard this. Yeah, it became a very seminal article. What it is like to be a bat. And I think maybe he chose a bat because bats experience the world very differently. They use, is it radar?
Echolocation.
What? Echolocation. Echolocation to navigate without seeing. So it's like another sense. Like we have seeing and hearing. They have this kind of, almost we could call like a sense that we humans don't have. And we can't really imagine that, what that's like to be a bat. But we can, we have a strong intuition that there is, there must be something it is like to be a bat. I think is the gist of what he says, right? There must be something it's like to be a bat, even though the experience of the bat is very different.
I think his point, the thrust of this particle right here, was he made the comment, even if we knew everything possible to know about the bat, anatomically, physiologically, everything about its brain, we still wouldn't know what it was like to be a bat. We'd still be somewhat like where Dogen talks about. We have to fish, you know, with a golden or transparent glass.
So, yeah, the particular unique experience of batness, we would not know what that's like. So it may be, since I don't remember all of the article, I know that, because it was a seminal article, in the, what we say, like, phenomenology, what's the field, like, kind of like study of the self is where at least later people really picked up on his article and when talking about what is it to be a self. So I don't know if he mentioned self in the article. Do you all remember?
No.
But it seems like that's the people that, where I've heard this is people are studying a consciousness and self in kind of modern Western scientific community, use this term, and it's a little controversial in the scientific community because it's such an unscientific way of talking. There's something it's like to be a bat. The scientists are like, what? Like, come on, define it. Define it, you know.
They started to use the word qualia. What it's like to taste an apple. Internal,
yeah. I think it also phrase gets referred to when we're talking about what we call reflexive awareness or awareness that's knowing itself. Awareness knows the world, that's knows sights and sounds and so on, but within both the modern scientific community and some schools of Buddhism, there's some debate in Buddhism, but generally the Yogacara tradition talks about this reflexive awareness or self-cognizing awareness, not meaning cognizing myself, but cognizing itself. Awareness is aware of itself at the same time as it's aware of objects, which is why we remember experiences. We remember we remember the awareness of an experience, not just the color and the sound. We remember what it was like to be having that experience. So that's sometimes how they try to make a case for there must be this. There must be, awareness must be aware of itself, must be illuminating itself at the same time as it's illuminating objects. Yes?
This is a great way of talking about the world because I think it extends reverence to so many different species that we might ignore, including fungi and different plants.
Yep. Yeah.
They have great integrity in their being.
Totally.
They're living out something.
Especially if there's any kind of consciousness, and it's hard for us to know the depth of possibilities of how consciousness can manifest. Yeah, like fungi are interesting because they're not exactly an animal and they're not exactly a vegetable. This is a fungi. It's a reishi mushroom. See, it's the supposedly the origin of these Zen sticks. It's petrified. No, actually, it's carved wood. But it's in old China, these were like, they call it as you wish stick, as you like it. In Japanese, we say nyoi, as you wish. Like it's they use for like wish fulfilling jewels. Like this can be whatever you want it to be. That became, and then in Zen, they maybe were first like looked really like mushrooms, and then they became more and more stylized, like the staff. So other we use just like a little neat little twist, but apparently they're originated from these reishi mushrooms, and just. As I was thinking about this, I thought, this vulture peak, for some reason in Chinese, they translate it as Reizan, the same ray as Reishi, which means like spiritual mountain or mystical mountain, something like that, instead of using vulture. So in our channel we say sacred vulture peak, but in Chinese they kind of drop the Great Akuta for some reason. And so something about this peak is so sacred, and it's reishi just means sacred mushroom, and it's medicinal, right? Yeah, it's healing properties.
It's true that we don't have eternal location, but it's also true that if one sense is not functioning, other senses become enhanced.
Yeah, that's true.
And with blind people, yeah. Mm-hmm. Their sense of ego location, mm-hmm. it gets enhanced too.
Mm-hmm.
It completely transforms, but it's operating more complex and higher levels.
Yep.
Us with all us.
Mm-hmm. There's a book about written by a blind person who was blind. Maybe became blind as a small child, and DeMello? Does anyone know this?
Anthony DeMello?
Was he blind?
No.
No, I don't think it was Anthony DeMello.
But
there's a book.
Who's the Israeli eye specialist up in the Bay Area?
Hmm.
Who was blind as a child?
Oh, I don't know. Oh, I don't know. This was quite a bit older, and Sojin Roshi, Mel Weitzman, was really into this book as a kind of a Dharma topic, apparently, because he learned to see without seeing through his eyes. He could feel where things were in the room intuitively, and he writes very detailed description of this, and he noticed that whenever he was like agitated, or like especially angry, he would lose the ability completely. But when he was really calm and relaxed, he could kind of tell where things were and could walk through doors and stuff without feeling things, just by knowing. It was like he developed this other sense. But when he wasn't still and really present, he'd lose it. And I think he eventually got his eyesight back. Anyway, and as Liz says, yeah, we can appreciate all these different species when we remember that it's something it's like to be them. But the reason that I like to bring it up in this discussion is because, is it Thomas Nagel? Thomas Nagel. He would be amazed that someone was using this phrase to try to talk about Buddha nature. But That's why I think it has some potential, because if we make this distinguishing, which this might be going beyond this article, right? But where there's something it's like to be a bat, it's, we will never know what that's like. But then what I would propose is there's something that it's like to be kind of the awareness of a bat. There's something it's like for that awareness to be knowing itself. There's something it's like to be experiencing as a bat. Even though the experience the bat is having is completely different than ours, there's something it's like to be experiencing for a bat. And my intuition, maybe this sounds far-fetched, my intuition is that's something it's like to just be experiencing, bottom line experiencing, just to be alive, is exactly the same as what it's like for me, Kokyo, to be experiencing. That's what me and the bat share. That's like the Buddha nature is identical. The experience is completely different. And the experiencer, the sense of maybe self, the sense of being an individual self, I think it would be completely different for me and the bat. But the experiencing, just knowing, just cognizing, period, that's my intuition, is that that would be identical for Kokyo and the bat, and maybe even for fungi. Yes. Experiencing. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Exactly. This kind of teaching is the root of great, unhindered, unbiased compassion. Oh yeah. And there's something, and maybe this is a little bit of a human projection. To say that this experiencing, this what it is likeness to be experiencing, is I as a human feel like there's something sacred about that. By sacred, I guess what I would mean is it's totally mysterious. It's sacred because it's like totally mysterious. When we really stop to appreciate the fact that there's something it's like to be aware at all, putting aside any the content of our experience, it's total mystery. It's total gift. And for that reason, I and maybe other spiritual traditions would call that sense of mystery, we call that sacred. And then we can say all life is sacred just because it's a total mystery. So yeah, compassion comes in this, and total appreciation and gratitude comes from this, awe comes from this, simply noticing there is something it's like to be aware. And maybe the most radical point of all, that this may be a leap. Excuse me if it's too much of a leap, you can sit with this one, but if There's that which is like to be aware for me, and that which is like to be aware for a bat and maybe even a fungi, is bottom line, we have to really be sure we're not talking about the content of experience. We're just talking about being aware, irregardless of content or like modes of perception. Bottom line, core sense of just being aware. If that is identical, like without the slightest difference for all beings, then could we say that there isn't really any grounds for saying my what it's like to be aware and your what it's like to be aware are different? If we're saying they're identical, we're not saying like identical means really what identical means is like one. It's not like they're very, very similar and there's thousands and billions of different what it's like to be awares. There's billions and billions of what it's like to be having a particular experience. That one's infinite variety. But the what it's like to be aware, could it be that there's only one? When we say like one mind in Zen, could it be that it's literally talking about one what it is likeness that's then like expressing itself as infinite different experiences through different sentient beings? That's a kind of a leap, I know, but it's worth opening to the possibility. Yes. Yes, every bird, every bat, every fungi is an immense world of delight closed to our particular five senses. And you could say our particular five senses are what closes from the bird's world of delight. There's a true person of no position shared by the bird and the fungi and the bat and me, moving in and out through these particular senses of this person. And then it kind of, this true person of no position then moves into your eyes and out your ears and into my mouth. And we can't see it. It's not really moving at all. But Linji says, technically he actually says, there's one true person in that koan. They often don't translate the one, because it's just a little too hard for us sometimes to open to oneness. Yes.
And then it begs the question about walls, tiles, and pebbles.
Yeah.
I've heard Native American spiritual leaders talk about responsibility to take care of the light and the shadows and the water and the air.
Yeah.
And it really blows my livelihood as a gardener. I approach the plants and I think what's skillful in working with them is to appreciate what they're like and what is kind of their character, but then what the gardener does is kind of enhance it in the human view. Like, oh, this is really pretty and it just layers over itself just this way and it likes to grow this way. You kind of you enhance it,
or you help it do its thing.
Take out the parts that's not looking so much like that, and leave the part that is showing it. But it's kind of like makes me feel like asking permission more. Okay, really, if you grew the dead branch, who am I to cut it off?
Yeah. We project our human experience onto everything. We can't help it. And maybe the trees are projecting their thing onto us too, we don't know. But I think it is, it's actually like kind of challenging to me to open to that there is something it's like to be a rock. Trees I'm more open to it. But I think you're right that the Native Americans might say, yeah, there is something it's like to be a rock, but it's just so I'm so influenced by the emphasis on consciousness in Buddhism, and it's hard to for me to imagine a rock kind of having a kind of consciousness. It almost seems like it doesn't need one. It kind of seems extra for a rock. But it's my vow to open to that possibility, that there is something it's like to be a rock. again, something it's like means there's a kind of self-cognizing awareness that is aware. There's an awareness of itself, usually at the same time as awareness of other things. And maybe just because rocks don't have what we consider sense faculties and nervous system, it's harder for me to open to it. Plants do seem to have receptivity to external stimuli. So they respond differently. You could say a rock responds when water keeps wearing at it, you know, it moves, but anyway.
That one there is saying, why did you take me from my family?
Yeah.
Maybe that one's the doctor.
This is like getting like talk about sidetrack. In the verse of chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha says, beautifully translated by Kumarajiva in 5-character lines, since I attained Buddhahood, the number of kalpas that have passed is incalculable hundreds, thousands, myriads, and billions of long eons. And the verse starts with ji-ga, which both mean self or I. Ga is what's used for Atman and the true self and the Buddha nature. And that in the Nirvana Sutra, ji is what's used in jiji-yu-zamai for like the self-enjoyment samadhi, which parenthetically, this jiji-yu is a form, one way of translating sambhogakaya. Interestingly, I think it's interesting that when sambhogakaya is taught, it was sometimes taught by asanga as self-enjoyment body and an other enjoyment body, a sva sambhogakaya and a para sambhogakaya. And sva sambhogakaya in Chinese and Japanese is translated as jijiyu, literally self-enjoyment. So there's something in here about the central teaching of Dogen. Dogen's Zazen is like self-enjoyment, and remember, sambhogakaya is the knowing or realizing of non-duality. We'll just leave it at that before we go on a huge rampage of tangent. but this verse, Dogen kind of says that, right? Of the rocks, tiles, and pebbles are all resonating in Jiji-yu Zamai. That's the chant that we do at noon, is kind of implying that everything is enjoying itself in this way. Well, I think it's interesting that this verse starts out with I, myself. It's really emphasized with two words for self or I. It's this reaching Buddhahood. Since I am Buddha, since I have become Buddha. This I is another way of saying there's something it's like to be who we are. Not even there's something it's like to be individually who we are, is like our kind of small I, and there's something that's just like to be aware. It's like the true self we all share. Since the self attained Buddhahood, the number of kalpas that have passed is incalculable, hundreds, thousands, myriads, and billions of long eons, constantly or eternally nitya. I have voiced the Dharma, teaching countless millions of living beings so that they entered the Buddha way. All this for immeasurable kalpas. Now, if we say this is really now being mainly taught by the Sambhogakaya, who realized Buddhahood eons ago, but it keeps appearing freely in any possible form as rocks, tiles, and pebbles to teach us. Everything is teaching us, and maybe the Native Americans really learned that from the rocks, and realized Buddhahood through the teaching of Sambhogakaya as rocks, tiles, and pebbles. But there's something interesting here about, for these eons, I have been teaching Dharma in like infinite forms. I don't think it means it's like Buddhism. This is like big Dharma is being taught infinitely and, you know, inconceivably and endlessly in order to liberate all beings as skillful means. I appear to have entered nirvana. And it's that word appears, that word gen, that as in Genjo Koan, that Dogen loves to use. Manifest, we could say. Manifestation or actualization. Gen, so we could say. As skillful means, I have manifested entering parinirvana. I appear to have entered nirvana. I'm expressing the display of nirvana. Yet truly, I do not cease. I am not extinct. I have not entered cessation, nirodha, or nirvana. Part of what's going on here that's maybe important to know is this Buddhist understanding that the goal for in early Buddhism is to enter parinirvana, or to not be reborn again, to realize non-coming and going so thoroughly that when this body dies, there's no more birth in a new body. That's the early Buddhist model, and the Buddha's parinirvana was like, parinirvana means complete cessation. It's like the end of like eons of lifetimes up to that point. This was like the great celebration. It's like, no more. We think that's maybe kind of weird. You'd like, that's so cool to totally cease. But in a world where there's like, you're really aware of like how much suffering there is, and maybe 500 BC in India, people didn't live long. There weren't so many good medicines, and life was tough, and practitioners especially felt like, I don't know if I want to like keep doing this over and over and over. That's the early model, but it all changes here with the Lotus Sutra, right? It's the cessation thing, that certain people are into the cessation thing. Akka manifests cessation for them. He even talks this way, it's important. Or in this chapter he says, more small-minded people who are into the cessation thing, I'll manifest it for them. I'll manifest parinirvana for them if they're into it. But actually, for the people maybe in modern America, they're not even so into cessation anyway. So like, in order to help them in 2020, I'm going to keep abiding here on Vulture Peak and every other place, and keep teaching without cessation. That's kind of the theme of this chapter, it seems like, is no cessation, ever present, always, now. There's no end to now. I truly do not cease. I always abide here to voice the Dharma. I forever abide in this world, but use my powers of spiritual penetration, or, you know, Jinsu, which is in Japanese, the name of a Shobogenzo chapter called, like, Miracles. I think Catherine Thomas translated Shobogenzo Jinsu as Miracles. So we could say, I use my power of miraculousness so that confused living beings, though nearby, fail to see me. And then Dogen, mentioned yesterday, Dogen loves this chapter of the Lotus Sutra. So in his Shobogenzo chapter on Dharma flowers, turning Dharma flowers, Dogen says, regarding this line, he quotes this line, I forever abide in this world, but use my powers of spiritual penetration so that confused living beings, though nearby, fail to see me. Dogen says, when Buddha says this, who has trust and understanding? Which was the beginning of the chapter yesterday we heard. Buddha says, have trust and understanding in what I'm about to say. So Dogen says, when Buddha says this, who has trust and understanding, and who has trust and beyond understanding? That's Dogen's twist on it, which I think is, means like, we're not going to understand this with our usual conceptual mind. Can we trust this and go beyond our usual understanding? But when I think about this sentence in the sutra, it seems funny to me that the Buddha is saying, I'm using skillful means here to hide myself from people. I'm with all of you all right now, but I'm using my miraculous powers so that you don't see me. We might say, why is he doing that? But he goes on to say, all those viewing me as extinct, like having ceased into parinirvana, everywhere venerate my relics. We even put like Vulture Peak on an altar, piece of stone. If Buddha was still alive, we might not care so much about Vulture Peak. He's always there, and like we go visit him any time. But now it's like, that's where the Buddha lived so long ago, and I didn't get to see him in person. I feel sad about that. So maybe this is why, with Buddha's miraculous powers, he hides himself so people don't see him, so that then they venerate his relics. All harbor feelings of yearning and arouse adoring hearts. When beings have become sincerely trusting or faithful, honest and upright, with gentle intention, wholeheartedly wishing to behold the Buddha, not begrudging their own bodily lives, then I, actually in the Sanskrit version of the sutra, it even says, Atma, Atman. Myself, the self, and the assembled Sangha appear together on sacred Vulture Peak. Then I tell the living beings that in this world I abide without end, without cessation, by the power of expedient means, upaya, appearing to be extinct or not extinct, appearing to cease or not cease. So something about this, like the doctor story, right? If I appear to be gone, then beings will harbor feelings of yearning and arouse adoring hearts. And I really want to meet the Buddha. When we become trusting, honest, and upright with gentle intention, with one mind wholeheartedly wishing to behold the Buddha, not begrudging our own bodily lives. That's what Sasheen is all about, right? Begrudging is like being stingy with our bodily lives. Sasheen is like, we really get to, I'm going to give my body to Buddha, the Sasheen, and it's not going to be comfy. How often do we get to not begrudge our own bodily lives outside of Sasheen? Really, it's, I think, a one way to look at Sasheen, is not begrudging our bodily lives. My butt is really sore on this cushion, but I sit for Buddha, wholeheartedly wishing to behold the Buddha. And so wholeheartedly wishing to behold the Buddha is Ishin, one mind, we can translate it as wholehearted, which they did here, or we could say single-mindedly, but also in Zen, one Ishin, one mind, has this other meaning too, right? We share this one, what it is likeness. So he could say, with one mind wishing to see Buddha, kenbutsu, here it says behold, but it's kenbutsu, and Dogen has a chapter called kenbutsu, called seeing Buddha, and I'll just finish with this Dogen quote on this line. So Dogen says, quotes this line of the sutra, wholeheartedly wishing to see the Buddha, not begrudging their own bodily lives, and I, the assembled Sangha, appear together on sacred Vulture Peak. And then Dogen comments, this wholeheartedness, or we could say single-mindedness, spoken of now, is not that of ordinary people or Shravakas and Pratheka Buddhas. It is the wholehearted endeavor to see Buddha. This wholehearted endeavor to see Buddha is, quote, Vulture Peak, unquote. This is the wholehearted endeavor to see Buddha. It is Vulture Peak. And later he says in the sutra, I abide on sacred Vulture Peak and every other dwelling place. So I think what Dogen is doing here is saying, this very place, this specific place, here we actually happen to be at Vulture Peak. There's not too many places in Santa Cruz where you can literally say we're sitting at Vulture Peak. But this Zendo, we can say it. Today, anyway. So, this wholehearted endeavor to see Buddha is Vulture Peak, is Warm Jewel Temple, is this very place. It is, quote, the assembled Sangha appear together, unquote. This quoting the sutra. This wholehearted endeavor to see Buddha is the assembled Sangha appears together here at Vulture Peak. This way we all are together right now is the wholehearted wish to see Buddha. Kind of. It's going to start to feel that way in Sesshin. This wholehearted wish to behold the Buddha, Kenbutsu, is Vulture Peak. It is the assembled Sangha appear together. When each of you at this very moment aspires to see Buddha, you do so with Vulture Peak mind. Thus, whole heart, or we could say one mind, I'm just going to use one mind here, but it's the wholeheartedly wishing, right? Thus, one mind is no other than Vulture Peak. How can one body not come forth together with one mind? How can one body and mind come forth together? Thus, I and the assembled Sangha appear together on sacred Vulture Peak is the one mind aspiring to see Buddha. There is something it is like to be sitting here on Vulture Peak and the bottom line is we share this something it is like. The assembled Sangha together shares what it is likeness to be here, now. As somebody who's in Rajagriha in India, and sitting on Vulture Peak right now, they are also here, the boundless here, they are now, timeless now, and there's something it's like to be alive and aware on Vulture Peak in India now, and that, what it is like, is the same what it's like to be us sitting here right now. And Shakyamuni Buddha, who taught the Lotus Sutra on Vulture Peak a long time ago in human time, there was something it was like to be him teaching the Lotus Sutra, and there's something it was like to be listening to the Lotus Sutra on Vulture Peak at that time. And the most basic quality of that what it was likeness is the same what it's like to be here now listening to Dogen talk about Shakyamuni Buddha talking about Vulture Peak. What is it like? Oh, rocks?
It rocks.
It rocks. It rocks. It tiles. It pebbles. It rocks. We'll just sit on Vulture Peak today, I guess. Really, we can't say. We won't say. We refuse to say. But if any merit has accumulated during our sitting on Vulture Peak, we offer it throughout the all time and space to touch the single heart of every sentient being and open all beings to the inconceivable Buddha way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.